go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Sorry for the tardiness, everyone. It's 6 minutes past the hour. I, Bob Kincaid, am 6 minutes late for the program. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, up until about 5 o'clock this morning, known as an internet-based telephone call-in program. Gee, Bob, why would you say something like that? Well, here, let me kill the music and explain. It was about 5 o'clock this morning. Understand, please, that beware the Ides of March. What were we talking about at the beginning of the program Friday? It was late on the Ides of March when snow began to fall, and it fell all through the day on Sunday and fell into early this morning overnight. And it was at 5 o'clock this morning, and, you know, I don't mean to sound like a ninny, but what the hell, you know. I've gotten to where when we're experiencing, and this is just, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a nice little pharmacologic pill that could make it all better for me. You know, maybe I could take a sleeping pill and, you know, get homicidal or suicidal or zoicidal or, you know, whatever. But it was about 5 o'clock this morning, and this heavy, wet snow had been falling all day. I'd say there's about 4 inches out on the ground. And because I worry about things like that, I was wide awake. And at 5 o'clock, the power went off. Now, bear in mind, we maintain a bank of, let's see, one, thank you, Randy, two, three, four, five separate uninterruptible power supplies back here in the studio. One of which has the telephone processor on it. The power went out at 5 a.m. The ancient, antiquated, tied together with wet toilet paper and baling wire, coal-fired, American Electric Power-owned Appalachian Power grid went down. And when it went down, well, it came back up. And when it came back up, the power briefly flickered, and then I heard, apparently not too far away, bang! And the power went down again. And then it flickered back on. And again I heard, bang! And it went out again. There was a little bit longer interval of time, but then for the third and what would be final time, it flickered on, followed by, bang! And the power stayed off. And then a couple of minutes went by, and it went bang again. And another minute passed, and I heard again, bang! Yeah, that was my 5 a.m. So just because I wanted to document when this was going on, I tweeted it. If you want to follow my Twitter feed, which is sometimes cranky, like at 5 o'clock in the morning when the tired, old, poorly maintained, profit-driven, nothing but profit, profit always, everything must be goddamn profit, coal-fired power grid that relies on technology that's about 70 years old, went down, I tweeted it, at Bob Kincaid. That's my Twitter handle. My tweets carry over onto my Facebook page, Bob Kincaid. Yes. Anyway, so I wanted to document it, and it sucked. And the power only came back a couple or so hours ago, at which point I mean, you can't do any. I'm surprised we have internet. Usually when the power goes down, the folks at Shentel are hours behind having the internet back up behind it. Now, bear in mind, the bangs were not in this house, and the bangs were not in the studio. They were somewhere out there as transformers were popping like, I don't know, those first three or four kernels of popcorn you put in the oil. Remember when we used to cook popcorn in oil on the stove and didn't have to rely on a microwave oven? Yeah. You'd put in two or three kernels, and when all four kernels had popped, you knew your oil was hot enough to put the rest of the corn in. Well, that's what it was like. So as soon as the power came back, I ran back here to start firing things up. Well, back up. As soon as the power went out, I fumbled my way back here into the studio while the power supplies were still supplying power on, the battery backups, and shut them and shut all the equipment down and shut then the uninterruptible power supplies down. Right. And then the power comes back a couple of hours ago. And we fire everything up. One by one, little by little. You don't want to overload stuff. You just bring on one thing at a time. In the chat room, Verblin, is it clean coal, Bob? Yes, Erblin, it is clean unicorn sparkle pony leprechaun coal. Had to work the leprechauns in there, what with this being St. Patty's Day. Big aura. So, little by little, I brought the studio back up. And, let's see, main production computer. Check. Streaming computer. Check. Laptop Skype computer. Check. Mix desk. Check. Compressor. Check. Comrex Stack 6 incredibly expensive 10-year-old telephone processor. Another story. Here, for those of you who are electronically inclined, you might appreciate or enjoy this sound. Stand by, please. Obviously, this thing has a couple of processors in it, and it runs through a booting routine. Only it isn't doing that. Instead, it's making this noise. Remember how I explained on Friday on the front porch that we've got six telephone lines, but only four of them can go through the hybrids? That's hybrid number one. Here's hybrid number two. Yeah, that's hybrid number two. Note coming in from Jay Cruz, and oh my God, Bob, please get it right. You sound like one of our idiot customers down here. You aren't hearing transformers popping. Those are fuses blowing. It could be either a transformer fuse or a fuse for overhead or underground primary line. Well, we don't have any underground lines, Jay Cruzen, so we can rule that out. I am not an electrician. I know I heard four explosions sufficient to rouse me straight up, you know, out of my seat. There, is that better? I heard five explosions. It didn't sound like a fuse popping, unless it was a great goddamn big giant honking humongous fuse. But there were five of them. So, you know, don't hold it against the customers for not knowing whether it's a transformer or an entire goddamn substation or a fuse. You know, we're just out here being consumers. In my case, consumers of almost exclusively coal-fired electricity on a really, really shitty, antiquated, piss-poor infrastructure grid that probably hasn't changed much since the 1950s. So a small fuse popping, according to Jay Cruzen, live and learn. He says, nope, those are actually small fuses. Okay, well, a small fuse blowing can make apparently an explosive sound you can hear from 2 miles away. And what I mean by that is it was louder than any .30-06, any 300 mag. Because, you know, we're used to, like, deer season around here. And, you know, the first day of deer season, it sounds like a war. And you tend to play duck and cover when they start. Okay, so apparently a little bitty, itsy-bitsy, teeny-tiny little fuse blowing can make an explosive sound, you know, 2 or 3 miles away. Well, I guess it's not surprising. You can set off a bomb big enough to take down 4 Murrah Federal buildings, and it can be 40 miles away and rattle your windows and crack your foundations. You know, this didn't rattle our windows. Okay, so it's a fuse. Well, live and learn. I will never refer to transformers blowing again. But what I do know is that when whatever it was that happened, happened, and we recovered from it, we got this. And this. Which is the sound of a telephone talk radio program dying. So stand by. Well, there's no sense in running that god-awful current into the mixer, so stand by. So the upshot... Oh, now Jay Cruzen's telling jokes. File a claim with your electrical company. that's the evening's first toaster. Those miserable sacks of shit at Appalachian Power wouldn't pay a penny if I sued them all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. Meanwhile, just out of curiosity, knowing as we do that Appalachian Power wants a $68 million rate increase from the West Virginia Public Service Commission this very year, I got curious about their share price. So I looked it up. You know, it's like, they looked, you know, just like in the Christmas Carol, the first Noel, they looked up and saw a star. Well, I looked up share prices for Appalachian Power. Quarterly dividend history. Actually, this is American Electric Power's dividend history because they own Appalachian Power. Dividends are paid on or about March 10th, June 10th, September 10th, and December 10th to shareholders of record on or about February 10th, May 10th, August 10th, and November 10th, respectively. Well, we don't have any 2014 numbers, but Jay Cruzen, all kidding aside, he says, all joking aside, they have a claims department, give them a call. All joking aside, I've been down that road. They have an entire army of people whose job is to say three words. We don't pay. Anybody remember the derecho? Yeah, me too. I got we don't paid right into the ground, even though their power surges that day they couldn't manage to keep their coal-fired grid on the air because they string wires on toothpicks through the woods and don't maintain their right-of-ways. They don't pay. You need to file that with FEMA. Let's see. Let's look at, it was 2012 when the derecho came through. And that would be June the 29th. Let's see. Second quarter ended May 10th. Third quarter ended August 10th. So, hey, look, 2012, when the derecho came through and 1.5 million human beings did not have electricity for something on the order of 2 weeks or more, they still paid out 47 cents a share on American Electric Power stocks, even though, you know, they weren't able to actually serve the public. What a bunch of losers. Well, no, the losers are, of course, the people who pay them not to deliver electricity. So, isn't that interesting? They have thus far managed to pay a tidy little, let's look at some of the rest of it. Since, golly Moses, well, this is unbearable. All the way back in 2004, they were only able to pay an annual share dividend of $1.40 a share. Well, I'm assuming these are dollars, 1.40. They ain't negative numbers. And the lowest since the year 2000, the lowest dividend has paid is 0.35. They are trading right now at about in the neighborhood of $49-$50 a share. And even though they can't keep the power on, there is always a profit for the shareholders. Even when grandmothers swelter through 2 months or 2 weeks of brutal heat in high summer, even when families go days without electricity in the dead of winter, somehow or another, they can still declare a dividend and award a profit to their precious, darling shareholders. This is a case of socializing the profit capitalizing the loss. It's your tough luck there, ratepayer. So forgive me if I'm not in the finest of frames of mind this evening. But, you know, that's how runaway capitalism works. Ick. So, here's the practical upshot. Until something happens with the Comrex, we're dead in the water for taking phone calls. The only way to get calls through to the program here is via Skype, which mercifully Appalachian Power did not figure out how to kill. And to do that later in the program, all you need do is send a contact to me, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, on Skype. And if we are not already contacts and friends or whatever it is one is on Skype, we will be as quickly as you send one through. It's not easy just to look past this. A radio program that features phone calls is not much of a radio program without phones. At that point in time, we become pretty much a podcast. So there you have it. It was too late in the day once I figured out that Appalachian Power had screwed us. It was too late in the day to get hold of the folks at Comrex and find out what it would take to get it repaired. God only knows. Who knows if they've even still got parts for a 10-year-old unit. What I find interesting, however, is that they were able to blow this right through the right past the uninterruptible power supplies. Unless, of course, it came through Chantel's unit. I guess that's possible. Although, in light of the fact that they were never really affected, it seems unlikely. Oh, well. Time to figure all of that out later. And it's just frustrating. It's frustrating. And maybe what we have here is actually tonight's first nominee for Moran Monday. I'm not sure if the nominee should be states like West Virginia, who allow their public service commissions to become wholly owned subsidiaries of the utilities, or whether the Morans are. No, they're not Morans, are they? The coupon clippers and profit takers of the shareholders of American Electric Power. They don't give a shit if anybody's got electricity as long as they've got their goddamn quarterly dividend, right? Mandated by state statutes in the various states. Because why? Because money. Because states grant a monopoly. To these utilities that allows them to, in turn, make a profit no matter how craptastic their services are. Neat how that happens, huh? There's a nomination in there somewhere. Ha, 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 ha. Jay Cruzen says, I'll take the nomination for thinking they might pay your claim. No, don't worry about it. It's no. Maybe power companies elsewhere are more responsive, but not these clowns. You'd have to have long and working understanding of the intricacies of being routinely screwed by Appalachian Power. I mean, for instance, if you go and you watch the documentary that got a lot of people saw, The Last Mountain, we talked a lot about it here. There is a scene in The Last Mountain where Robert F. Kennedy interviews this nasty little man from the West Virginia Coal Association. I will not dignify him by giving his name. He's just a nasty little man. Got a little pencil-thin porn stash. He's just a nasty little man. And the nasty little man tells Robert Kennedy, well, this here power plant is state-of-the-art. And it happens to be a power plant that's down at Glasgow, West Virginia, down off the mountain and along the Kanawha River. That state-of-the-art power plant, and it's filmmaking at its finest, they let the nasty little man talk about how it's state-of-the-art, and it makes clean coal electricity. And they let him do all this lying, and eventually it turns out, it's not state-of-the-art at all. It's pumping tons of toxins into the air, hour by hour, day by day, week by week, year by year, and is not in compliance with various and sundry federal laws. Yeah, see, Jan pointing out, nope, Bob Kincaid, you're not going to this part's implied, you're not going to get that thing paid for. In Washington State, my mom lost many items due to a storm taking a tree that took down her power on her house. Act of God insurance, not responsible. We don't pay. Whether it's an insurance company or a utility, there are usually entire phalanxes of people whose the only words they ever have to say is, we don't pay. So there's that. But, oh well. Anyway. This is Moran Monday. And I tweeted this op-ed piece from the New York Times that other people could read it and share it, hopefully. It is from the Sunday Review. The link I tweeted was. And the title of the piece is Paul Ryan's Irish Amnesia. Now, when I tweeted it out, I tweeted it as better title. Why Paul Ryan is a dirty, rotten, stinking, repulsive, feet-in-the-trough, soulless, parasitic hypocrite. And I guess what we could call this is our St. Paddy's Day Moran Monday nomination. Because this is, well, astonishing. It's astonishing only insofar as it is difficult to understand somebody who is actually a functioning human being thinking like Paul Ryan thinks. I'm just going to share with you what Timothy Egan wrote. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and has a column every Friday in the New York Times. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody, by the way. In advance of St. Patrick's Day, I went time traveling, Mr. Egan writes. Back to the 1840s and Ireland's Great Famine. On one side of the Irish Sea was Victorian England, flush with the pomp and prosperity of the world's mightiest empire. On the other side were skeletal people, dying en masse, the hollow-bellied children scrounging for nettles and blackberries. A great debate raged in London. Would it be wrong to feed the starving Irish with free food, thereby setting up a culture of dependency? Now, where have we heard that phrase before? Certainly England's man in charge of easing the famine, Sir Charles Trevelyan, thought so. "Dependence on charity," he declared, "is not to be made an agreeable mode of life." Thank you, Marty. Marty says, be careful, Bob. Paul Ryan and his supporters might want to sue you for defamation of character. Definition of character. What was that again? Yes. Paul Ryan is a dirty, rotten, stinking, repulsive, feet-in-the-trough, soulless, parasitic hypocrite. Definition of character. So let's go back to Charles Trevelyan. Dependence on charity is not to be made an agreeable mode of life. It can, however, if you're an Englishman who despises Irish people on principle, be an agreeable mode of death, the non-dependence of charity, that is. Timothy Egan writes, "And there I ran into Paul Ryan. His great-great-grandfather had fled to America, but the Republican congressman was very much in evidence." Wagging his finger at the famished, his oft-stated culture of dependency is a safety net that becomes a lazy day hammock, but it was also England's excuse for lethal negligence. On the charity continuum, Texas Betsy pointing out in Jewish law regarding charity, if someone asks for funds for a school, take the time to check thoroughly. If they ask for food, give them one meal's food or a day's food while you check out whether they are actually lacking food. And I suspect on a case-by-case basis that probably works. On the other hand, when you have famine in the land, and Lord knows you don't have to go far into the Bible before you start reading, well, the Old Testament mainly. We shouldn't call it the Bible. That just means the book. The ancient Hebrew sacred writings. That's a good word. Good phrase. You don't have to go far before you find, there's famine in Genesis. Because Joseph interprets a dream about famine in Egypt. Right? Right. But we're gonna, first there's what Timothy Egan writes. Then we're gonna take a look at, the Jewish Bible, that makes sense. Bible Biblos book. Right. Okay. Although I can't see calling, it seems so discordant to refer to, for instance, the Bhagavad Gita, or maybe the sutras as the Buddhist Bible. Then again, you can go to Wally World and probably find something called the Fisherman's Bible. And doesn't have any cast your nets upon the water and I'll make you fishers. No, it doesn't have any of that there. Anyway, Ryan's great-grandfather had fled to America. Okay, we got that. It was also England's excuse for lethal negligence, that culture of dependency. There is no comparison, of course, between the de facto genocide that resulted from British policy and conservative criticism of modern American poverty programs. But you can't help noticing the deep historic irony that finds a Tea Party favorite and descendant of famine, Irish, using the same language that English Tories used to justify indifference to an epic tragedy. And by the way, let's at least offer some sort of a working definition of what that safety net is. That hammock. That culture of dependency. A family of two, I dug around a little bit over the weekend and found this out after reading this piece. A family of two with an income of a little better than $700 per month qualifies for $62 and change worth of food stamps. You heard that right. So 62 divided by 2 is 31. And 31 works out to being a dollar a day in the months that aren't September, April, June, and November, and February. A dollar a day, 7 months out of the year, and a dollar and pennies per day the other months of the year. That is Paul Ryan's hammock. A dollar a day. Now, a dollar a day will get you a, what, four-pack of the not-fancy ramen. A dollar a day will get you one package of the fancy ramen with the flavor booster. You know, for those hammock dwellers out there who insist on living profligate lives. It will take it'll take 4 days food on the SNAP benefits. It'll take 4 days food to buy a bag of potatoes, since we're talking about the famine here. And potatoes, the reason the famine happened is because potatoes are an amazing food. I don't know where it is in the archives, but if you go back somewhere, you will find an interview I did with Charles C. Mann, a conversation with Charles C. Mann. We had actually talked to him twice, first regarding his book 1491, and then when it came out, his book 1493, which is just a complete head realigner. And oddly enough, he has a chapter in 1493, chapter 6, that addresses the root causes and the history behind the Irish potato famine. Anyway, back to Mr. Timothy Egan. The Irish historian John Kelly, he says, who wrote a book on the Great Famine, was the first to pick up on these echoes of the past during the 2012 presidential campaign. Ryan's high-profile economic philosophy, he wrote then, is the very same one that hurt, not helped, his forebears during the famine and hurt them badly. I suppose one could also say hurt them deadly, given the millions who died. What was, Egan continues, a tired and untrue trope back then is a tired and untrue trope now. What was a distortion of human nature back then is a distortion now. And what was a misread of history then is a misread now. Ryan boasts of the Gaelic half of his ancestry on his father's side. I come from Irish peasants who came over during the potato famine, he said last year during a forum on immigration. I guess he didn't follow that with Igamfoo. I got mine, F you. He's a kiss up or kiss down type guy. Kiss up, kick down. Did I say that right? Okay. But with a head still stuffed with college boy mush from Ayn Rand, which I thought was a beautiful little rapier thrust between the ribs. With a head still stuffed with college boy mush from Ayn Rand, remember, who despised all forms of altruism, who despised Christianity, and despised charity, and despised welfare, who in her latter years went and signed right up for Medicaid and Social Security, you betcha, even though her books, even though her books had sold like hotcakes, and she had had plenty of wealth but had frittered the same away, Egan says, with a head still stuffed with college boy mush from Ayn Rand, He apparently never did any reading about the times that prompted his ancestors to sail away from the suffering sod. Centuries of British rule that attempted to strip the Irish of their language, their religion, and their land had produced a wretched peasant class subsisting on potatoes. When blight wiped out the potatoes, at least 1 million Irish died, 1 in 8 people. And it is a fact that to this day, the only nation in Europe that does not have a population greater than it had 150 years ago is Ireland. Because of the potato famine. Because money. John Mitchell wrote, "The Almighty indeed sent the potato blight, but the English created the famine." Egan notes that those words bought Mr. Mitchell a ticket to the penal colony of Tasmania. What infuriated Mitchell was that the Irish were starving to death at the very time that the rich stores of grain and fat livestock owned by absentee landlords were being shipped out of the country. The food was produced by Irish hands on Irish lands, but would not go into Irish mouths for fear that such charity would upset the free market and make people lazy. Ryan's running mate in 2012, Mitt Romney, Bishop Willard Romney to those who know his real name, made the Tory case with his infamous remark that 47% of Americans are moochers, dependent upon government, his words, not Mr. Egan's. Part of that dependence, he said, extended to people, quote, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. Food. The gall. And again, I reiterate that the nutrition assistance, the food assistance, that these godforsaken, soulless, parasitic, miserable, sociopathic, if not psychopathic, right-wingers, teabaggers, birthers, deathers, tenthers, and booger-eaters begrudge people is $1 a damn day. Remember Louis Gohmert complaining about that welfare family with their shopping basket, their jitney, all loaded up with the Alaskan king crab legs and his poor, hard-working constituent there in the first district of Texas who said, "I can't feed my family Alaskan king crab legs. How is it them welfare peoples can?" Now, never mind the fact that that's just a thin tissue of absolute lies. We shouldn't be surprised because, after all, Louis Gohmert is a fundamentalist Christian, therefore he is a liar. In his essay, Mr. Egan continues, "You can't make these kinds of heartless remarks unless you think the poor deserve their fate, that they have a character flaw born of public assistance. And there hovers another awful haunt of Irish history." In 2012, Ryan said that the network of programs for the American poor made people not want to work. We're going to take some of that not want to work stuff and have a hard look at it via West Virginia history in a few minutes. On Wednesday, last week, Ryan went further, using the language of racial coding. This, after he told, and you may recall Sandra mentioned this during Friday on the Front Porch last week. This, after he told a story, he being Ryan, of a boy who didn't want his free school lunch because it left him with a full, and this is a quote, a full stomach and an empty soul. The story was garbage, almost completely untrue. Here's the quote from Paul Ryan. we have this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular. There's some of that code. That means shiftless Negroes. Of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. In other words, these people are bred poor and lazy. The word in racial code is shiftless. Of course, it might be worth noting, and I can't remember if Mr. Egan makes this point later on. Paul Ryan has hardly ever worked an honest day's labor in his life. For a very brief time, up in Wisconsin, I believe, he was the driver of the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile, for which he was actually paid for his labor. Yeah. Then, when he got a little older and decided that he was going to leave the tranquil confines of Janesville, Wisconsin, and go to Washington, D.C., he was one of those khaki-pantsed, white-shirted, apron wrapped around his front waiters at the Tortilla Coast restaurant where folks from the House of Representatives come down and, you know, have private parties. They've got some excellent, excellent chips and salsa there at the Tortilla Coast. They really do. And among other things, they are the chips and salsa are among the cheapest stuff on the menu. That's why I know that they've got them. He worked there for a little bit, but beyond that, the only thing Paul Ryan has ever done is suck at the public teat. You will recall that he lived on and went to school on Social Security benefits when his father died when he was a teenager. As Charlie Pierce, happy St. Patrick's Day to you, Charlie, notes of Mr. Ryan, you're welcome, dickhead. Yeah. We the people who are out there trying to promote the general welfare and provide for the general welfare and promote tranquility, we made a decision once upon a time that children whose parents die early in their lives should not be consigned to some sort of miserable fate, but should perhaps have the benefit of the Social Security system so that they might still live to see their potential. That's how Paul Ryan wound up in Congress, where he is screaming that no one else, you know, I got mine, F you, Igum Foo. Anyway, with regard to this business of tailspin of culture, inner cities, the shiftlessness argument, Mr. Egan writes, where have I heard that before? Ah, yes, 19th century England. The Irish national character, Trevelyan, confided to a fellow aristocrat, was defective. The hungry millions were a selfish, perverse, and turbulent people, said the man in charge of relieving their plight. Remember, the guy who's saying all this is in charge of trying to keep people from starving to death. We have plenty of food here, if only they would pay money for it. See? Because if we give it to them, well, they'll just expect us to give them more. Mr. Egan writes, you never hear Ryan make character judgments about generations of wealthy who live off their inheritance or farmers who get paid not to grow anything. Nor, for that matter, does he target plutocrats like Romney who might be lulled into not taking risks because they pay an absurdly low tax rate simply by moving money around. Dependency is all one way. The whole British argument in the famine was that the poor are poor because of a character defect, said Christine Keneally, a professor of Irish studies and director of Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University. It's a dangerous, mean-spirited, and tired argument. And it wasn't true. The typical desperation scene of the famine was the furthest thing from a day in the hammock. Here's what one Quaker relief agent, William Bennett, found in a visit to County Mayo in 1847. We entered a cabin. Stretched in one dark corner, scarcely visible from the smoke and rags that covered them, were three children, huddled together. Lying there because they were too weak to rise, pale and ghastly, perfectly emaciated, eyes sunk, voice gone, and evidently in the last stage of actual starvation. For his role in the famine, Trevelyan was knighted. Really? The Irish remember him differently. At Quinnipiac's Great Hunger Museum hangs a picture of this English gentleman with a dedication. For crimes against humanity, never brought to justice. Timothy Egan closes saying, Irish Alzheimer's, goes the joke, is to forget everything but the grudges. In the case of the Great Famine, for good reason, what Alexis de Tocqueville called the terrifying exactitude of memory is burned into Ireland's soil. But more than forgetting, Paul Ryan never learned. This is a brilliant little piece of writing. And it should be brilliant. The guy's got a Pulitzer to his name. That generally means that he's a master of the art of knowing words. But here's the problem. As brilliant an indictment of Paul Ryan as that piece is, Paul Ryan will never read it. No one associated with Paul Ryan will ever read it to him. No timorous wee intern will ever, with shaking hand, slide it onto his desk and say, begging your pardon, sir, for your consideration. In other words, part of our national sickness lies in the fact that the Paul Ryans of this world are never confronted by anyone who disagrees with their essential hate-filled bitter ignorance. And while ignorance can be cured, no one will ever confront Paul Ryan with that cure. Remember, this is a guy who is famous for having given away copies of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged to people on his staff, and then demanding that they read it. Interesting, then, that he has never given away a copy of, say, the Book of St. Matthew, in which the guy that he expects to forgive all of his sins and admit him to eternal bliss in paradise warns against crapping on the poor. Because, you see, for a Paul Ryan, to confront the hatefulness of his statements would require the kind of work that even a 12-step program would be hard-pressed to get him to do. Because we all build these personal mythologies of our own. And if you're a right-winger, if you're a repiglick, and if you're a teabagger, if you are some birther, tenther, deather, booger-eater, bircher, libertarian, anarcho-randianist, you cannot at any time in your life confront the terrible, horrible, bowel-watering fact that you have been poor. And that you have relied upon the kindness of strangers to get where you are, because that would cause the entire myth to crumble. And would create an existential crisis, a personal existential crisis of monumental proportions. And so they talk to each other in echo chambers. I said that we would take a look at the origins of the potato famine. You can read the entirety of Chapter 6 of Charles C. Mann's 1493 and be astounded with the little pieces of unintentional clockwork precision that winds up with a million people starving to death as a result of English indifference in Ireland. But one of those, the potato is like so many of the other foods that are a part of the Columbian Exchange. The potato, in many ways, saved old world cultures. But it cursed as it crowned. The Prussians and the Austrians in the 18th century fought a potato war, each army trying to deprive the other of the ability to eat them, because, as people found out, you can actually live, and as the Irish people proved, you can actually live on a diet of nothing but milk, milk products, and potatoes. Because of the amazing nutritional value of that plant that over the course of thousands of years of human ingenuity in the Andes was taken from being deadly poison to brilliantly life-giving, life-sustaining. But ultimately, in the potato, you can find the history of the rise of intensive monoculture, fertilizer-driven farming, great boats full of batshit. No, really, batshit. Guano. See, you have to, over on the terrestrial airwaves that are censored by the government, you have to call it guano. Now, see here, Colonel Bat Guano, if that really is your name, over on the censored, the government-censored terrestrial airwaves where Rush Limbaugh can tell addictomy jokes about trans people, but someone can't say batshit, you have to call it guano. We, fortunately, for the time being, can still call it batshit, because that's what it is. And there are islands that contain great mountains of batshit. And Chinese people were lied to and essentially kidnapped, thinking they were going to California, and they were taken to become batshit miners off the South American coast, to load barges full of batshit, which would then cross the Atlantic and fertilize the potato crops. That, it is believed, is where the potato famine came from in the first place. It's a fungus. But the potato caught on big in Germany, Kartoffel, caught on big in the Netherlands, caught on big in Ireland, because it was a and here's the irony, it was a famine stopper. It was a famine preventer. Until it wasn't. And one of the ways that famine can get the blight can get hold of the potato is if the soil is allowed to remain wet, because that makes the that creates favorable conditions for the blight critter. And even without knowing they were doing it, because the Irish, despite all the jokes and despite all the derision, the Irish are and always have been fabulously creative genius peoples. The Irish figured out a way to plant their potatoes in such a way that the potatoes would thrive and they would have a nice yield. And it just turned out that the farming method Irish farmers had used for years and years and years, you know, you've heard Ireland referred to as the old sod. Well, they had cut the sod and flipped the sod blocks upside down and piled them into ridges with deep furrows in between. Because of anti-Irish bias, this was referred to as lazy bed farming. The ridges stood at least a foot or more above the furrows. And oddly enough, they looked strikingly similar to the very same way the indigenous Americans had grown their potatoes. The ridges kept down weeds. The ridges had wet soil. I mean, not wet, but the ridges had rich soil, and the water drained away. Enter Jethro Tull. No, really. Who was an agrarian reformer. And he said the Irish were doing it all wrong. They were raising their potatoes all wrong. That they needed to have closer furrows, and they were wasting land, and they could increase yield, and the increased yield could be used to sell and make because money. And so the so-called lazy bed method went away in favor of modern agricultural practice. Brought to you, modern agriculture. Like Monsanto, because money. And when that happened, the blight that created the potato famine was allowed to take hold. Charles C. Mann writes, Wacho, which is the American word for that lazy bed farming method. Wacho, the ridges, occupied a swath of northern Europe that reached from France to Poland and included Britain, Ireland, Scandinavian countries, and Baltic states. As the new methods took hold after about 1750, they disappeared. The raised ridge farming method disappeared. Wacho had almost vanished from Ireland by 1834 when reform enthusiast Edmund Murphy took a cross-country professional tour between Dublin on the east coast and Galway on the west, taking particular notice of the potato crop. Seeing few lazy beds in areas where they had once been ubiquitous, he crowed that they were completely superseded. Nothing shows the rapid improvement in agriculture, which is at present extending in this country, more clearly. Now remember, much of this farming was being done by what we would know here in America as sharecroppers because of that thing called the enclosure, whereby the wealthiest of the wealthy owned all the land, and in return for poor people working the soil, they were allowed to have a little plot of the absolute crappiest soil available upon which to raise their own food, so that there would not be a culture of dependency. Charles C. Mann continues, to examine the consequences of the shift to modern cultivation methods, Michael D. Myers, then at the University of Texas in Austin, experimentally created 6 fields in Northern Ireland, 3 lazy beds and 3 of the level fields that replaced them. He discovered that the simple ridges and furrows created a complex geography with surprisingly sharp temperature and humidity differences between the top of the ridge and the bottom of the furrow. Plant disease specialists describe the temperature and humidity conditions that favor P. infestans, that's the famine blight, in terms of blight units. The higher the number of blight units, the better the chance that blight zoospores on potato leaves will be able to germinate. Myers' lazy beds had roughly half as many blight units as the level fields. Blight spores were less likely to germinate in the comparatively warm, dry conditions atop the ridges. Because water drained into the furrows, it flowed away and beneath the growing tubers, carrying zoospores away from them. In addition, they had fewer noxious weeds and needed less fertilizers. And here's the irony. Murphy, denouncer of lazy beds, took his professional tour in 1837 because disease had been striking Ireland's potatoes. That was 1834, a decade before the blight. The diseases he was concerned with were viruses, bacteria, nematodes, and so on, ordinary pests that were adapting to the new crop. As the pests evolved, they caused crop failures. 14 occurred between 1814 and 1845. None of these incidents was anywhere as severe as the Great Hunger. Myers, the University of Texas researcher, came to believe these failures were due in part to the abandonment of lazy bed cultivation which inadvertently fostered plant disease. And by the way, it is, Charles C. Mann says, worth noting that the Andes did not have such widespread potato epidemics. The Great Hunger was the first truly contemporary agricultural disaster. Without the improvements wrought by modern science and technology, the blight would have had far less impact. Alarmed by the blight, governments in France, Belgium, Britain, and the Netherlands quickly asked biologists for help, but in its surge and sweep it was like nothing they had ever seen. During the next 40 years, researchers attributed the blight to ozone, air pollution, static electricity, volcanic action, smoke from steam locomotives, excessive humidity or heat, gases from the recently introduced sulfur match, an emanation from outer space, various insects, aphids, ladybugs, tarnished plant bugs, and the potato's own internal debilitation. Edward Hitchcock, a renowned natural historian at Amherst College, assigned blame to an atmospheric agency too subtle for the cognizance of our senses. Might as well have said demons. A few thought the cause was a fungus, but they were shouted down. No useful countermeasures were proposed. The plea for help went out to science. But science couldn't answer. And so, let's take another little step. And moving away from the potato famine itself, let's talk a little bit about what happened to some of the people who escaped the potato famine and didn't happen to have Paul Ryan's multi-great-grandpa. Let's look to 1904. It would happen to be the year that my grandmother was born. She was the youngest of my grandparents, lived the longest. And by 1904, in the burgeoning coal fields of West Virginia, which was staffed, among other things, by poor people, they came up with poor relief laws. Other states promulgated them as well, but this is the West Virginia version. An overseer of the poor is appointed by the county court, and understand, of course, and you know this, but I'll say it just the same in case we got any little lurking birthers, deathers, denters, baggers, booger eaters, birchers, what have you. Republicans, you know. An overseer of the poor is appointed by the county court for each magisterial district to hold office for 2 years. A legal settlement in a county is gained by continuous residence for 1 year, except when a person unable to maintain himself has immigrated into the state within 3 years. Necessary poor relief. Now, what I was going to say a minute ago, this, of course, predates things like Social Security, food stamps, unemployment compensation. By 1904, I think West Virginia did have a rudimentary workers' compensation system, but if it did, it was constrained by built-in mechanisms to make sure that injured workers couldn't be compensated. Things like the fellow servant rule, where if one was injured by the action of a fellow servant, one's defeat could be claimed, or one's injury could be defeated, is what I'm trying to say. Anyway. Necessary poor relief must be afforded whether a person has a settlement or not. But in case he is chargeable to another county or state, he must, if practicable, be removed thither at the expense of his place of settlement. You got that? If you're poor in County A, but it turns out that you're really from County B, County A has to pay to kidnap you and take you back to County B, where County B will have to pay for you being poor. The parents, children, brothers, and sisters of a poor person, if of sufficient ability, are liable for his support. In other words, if you can send a 10-year-old into the mines to support a crippled-up daddy, then the county doesn't have to contribute to his support. If there is a county infirmary, a pauper may not be kept at any other place except in emergency cases. So if you go to the fancy newfangled hospital because you're sick, but you happen to be poor, as quick as the emergency services are done with, they will ship you over to the county poor infirmary, where you can be left to rot and die. Every county court may establish a county infirmary for the poor, or the county courts of two or more adjoining counties may unite for this purpose. The county court may appoint an agent to have charge of the infirmary, subject to the control and regulations of the county. Such agent may not admit anyone to the infirmary except upon the written order of the overseer of the poor. Well, when's the last time we heard overseer? Yeah, out in the cotton fields. I'll be damned. Overseer. Or of said court. A member of the county court or one of the overseers must visit the infirmary at least once a month and report to the court. And the county court in this case is what we would recognize today, by the way, as a county commission. Provision must be made for the employment of the inmates. Notice that they were it was an infirmary, but it's an infirmary that has inmates. This is the so-called poorhouse of terrifying legend. Children kept at the infirmary, who are also inmates, are to receive proper education. Emphasis on the word proper. Proper education being something of a rather fluid definition. You're not going to teach physics to a poor kid at the poorhouse now, are you? Hell no! The county court must annually publish a report in detail of the poor relief in the county. And this is my favorite part. A penalty of $100 is prescribed for bringing an indigent person into the state. That's $100 in 1904. Anybody want to run out there and do the homework and find out what $100 in 1904 means in 2014, 110 years later? That's not chump change. So but if you think about it, Paul Ryan probably objects even to that. Because after all, that would create a culture of dependency, and the next thing you know, the county infirmary is just a whole bunch of hammocks strung between the trees as the poor lay there lazing about, being shiftless. Yeah. So there's a fine involved of $100 for bringing an indigent person into the state of West Virginia. What that means is that if you are, say, a coal company, and you go out and you round up some people and you bring them into the state, then if they don't want to wind up in the poorhouse, then what you do is you tell them they got one choice and one choice only, and that is to go to work in the mines doing whatever the hell they're told. Now, I don't want to be unsympathetic or clueless to any heritage issues, but if somebody if you're indigent and, you know, poor, and somebody brings you into the state, and you are compelled to do a job that they tell you to do, lest you become an inmate of the poor infirmary. Anybody want to give me a word for that? Pretty please. Thank you, Lottie. Lottie pointing out that $100 in 1904 is about $5,000 110 years later. Thus are the vicissitudes of unrestrained capitalism. So, I use West Virginia as the example because West Virginia is what I know. I have some data here from 1896, which would be 2 years after the birth of my grandmother. Because even in 1896, we were keeping tabs on this kind of thing. And I find this kind of thing educational simply because this is the world to which the teabaggers want to return. a world of inmates. And, well, if you left it to a teabagger, they probably wouldn't even want to fund the county infirmary. The real world that the teabaggers want to return to is that world described by the Quaker agent in Timothy Egan's article, who found children perfectly emaciated in the final stages of starvation in the midst of a filthy and smoke in a corner of a filthy and smoke-filled hut. Because that, by God, is freedom. So let's say you're not indigent. Let's say you're not shipped off to the county poorhouse. Let's say you've got a job in the booming coal economy of West Virginia. July 10th, 1896. William Pinkard, Angle Mine, McDowell County, was killed by a kettle bottom falling on him at the face of his room. Face and room are terms of art, meaning locations inside a coal mine. Also, July 10th, Lewis Price, Bloom Mine, Fayette County, killed by having the mine cars run over him, which broke his neck and inflicted other injuries. He was a driver and fell in front of a moving trip of mine cars. July 13th, Jacob Akers, Thacker Mine, Mingo County, was killed by a fall of slate. No further particulars accompanied this report. July 21st, 1896, John Yatinsky, Douglas Mine Number 1, Tucker County, was killed by a fall of slate which broke his neck. Anton Danspuce was present and witnessed the accident. July 28th, Hezekiah Law, Pulaski Mine, McDowell County, was killed by a fall of slate while operating an electrical mine machine. July 28th, 1896, there was electricity inside the mines in West Virginia, but not inside the homes. July 30th, Leander Bailey, Shamokin Mine, McDowell County, was killed by a fall of slate while working on a stump of coal. He was engaged in making an undercut in a stump of coal, which was supporting some loose coal and slate over him. The report of the coroner was that, quote, he met his death by a fall of slate, which was occasioned by his cutting coal from a stump when danger was imminent. August 1st, 1896, Isaac Rolinici, Montana Mine, Marion County, was injured by an explosion of powder from the effects of which he died on August 6th. He was at his working place in the mine and let a spark fall into his powder can in his toolbox, which exploded and burned him very badly, he having no shirt on at the time. Notice in the cases of Leander Bailey and Isaac Rolinici that an effort was made to make sure that blame was placed upon the worker for having caused his own demise. That way, there was no argument to be made that the coal company had to pay anything in way of support to his widows, to their widows and their orphans. August 11th, Carl McCluskey, Montana Mine, Marion County, was killed by a fall of slate at 7 p.m. Before leaving his work, he fired a shot, that means he set off a dynamite charge, and returned to see the results of the shot. A piece of loose slate, which had been made loose by the force of the shot, fell on him. August 17th, James H. Miller, Gilliam Mine, McDowell County, was killed by a fall of slate in his room. He was loading coal into a car when the slate fell on him, breaking his neck. September 19th, Robert Spradling, Beechwood Mine, Fayette County, was killed by a fall of slate. No further particulars accompanied the report upon this incident. These are all West Virginia state government documents. September 21st, W.H. Duncan, Pocahontas East Mine, Mercer County, was killed by a fall of slate. No report was made of this accident at the time of its occurrence. October 6th, Isaac Fell, Logan Consolidated Mine, Mingo County, was killed by a fall of coal. No details accompanied the report of this accident. The company failed to comply with the law in regard to reporting this accident at the time of its occurrence. That is October 6th, 1896. The company failed to comply. And there we were in February 2014, while a coal company waited hours and hours and hours and hours before reporting that it had dumped over 100,000 gallons of poison toxic waste into a stream in Kanawha County, West Virginia. Nothing! Nothing, nothing has changed. October 10th, R. Edward Gwynn, Arlington Mine, McDowell County, was killed by a fall of slate at the face of his room. After firing a shot, he returned to the face of his room to ascertain the effect of the shot. A piece of slate, killed him instantly. October 30th, John W. Rowe, Montana Mine, Marion County. You keep hearing these names over and over and over again of these mines. People were dying like flies. Because capitalism. Because they want it all. Because money. John W. Rowe, Montana Mine, Marion County, was killed by being caught between a moving trip of empty cars and the rib. The deceased was standing to one side of the track to permit the empty cars to pass by when a trip of loaded cars got beyond control of the driver and ran into the empty trip from a butt heading, derailing the empty cars and causing the same to squeeze and roll the deceased along the rib of coal. He was crushed to death. A little at a time. November 7th, Henry Stakes, Empire Mine. This is going to go all the way to June the 30th, 1897. Henry Stakes, Empire Mine, McDowell County, was killed by a fall of slate in his room. He was riding on the front end of an empty car, which he was letting into his room, which ran to the dip. Owing to the speed of the car or a defective track, the car jumped the track and knocked a prop out of its position, causing the slate to fall on him. All of these individuals are risking their lives, busting their asses, being paid next to nothing. Nothing, really, because they weren't being paid money. They were being paid company scrip that could only be used at the company store to buy goods at wildly inflated prices. To fuel the so-called Industrial Revolution in America. To make the Morgans and the Carnegies and the Mellons and the Rockefellers richer and richer and richer and richer, even though not one of those wildly wealthy men had any idea what he would ever do with all that money. If we lived in a world of tangible ghosts, the mansions they built would bleed daily by the minute with the gallons and gallons of blood that they shed in acquisition of their filthy wealth. Such to make the Amityville horror appear child's play. This goes on and on and on. I think maybe next Labor Day, maybe we should do 3 hours of program in which we do nothing but read off the names of the victims sacrificed on the blood-soaked altar of capitalism. But one last one. I saved this one because this gives back to August the 3rd, 1896. because this has a sort of relevance to Paul Ryan. August the 3rd, 1896. Alfred Aniston, Goodwill Mine, Mercer County, was killed by the loaded mine cars running over him on the inside of the mine. It is supposed that he had gone to sleep on the track and was not awakened upon the approach of the trip of cars. His occupation was a trapper, and he was a Negro boy, 12 years old. Notice it is supposed he fell asleep on the tracks because, you know, little exhausted 12-year-old Negro boys just naturally go to sleep on the tracks inside the mine. Do you know what a trapper was? A trapper was often the first job that a little boy would get when, by dint of necessity, so as not to become an inmate of the county poor farm. I'm sorry, infirmary. A 12-year-old boy would be given the job of trapper and paid a pittance. And his job was to sit at the trap door opening of the tracks through the mine, and when a trip of cars came along, his job as a trapper was to open the trap door for the cars to come through. But they suppose he fell asleep on the tracks. Why would a 12-year-old boy fall asleep on the tracks? Perhaps because he was underfed, undernourished, overworked, completely exhausted, dragging his 12-year-old body day after day after day to the coal mine so his family could eat something? But that line about supposed that he fell asleep bothers me. Could it be that some white guy just threw him out in front of the cars just to get rid of him? Maybe he'd looked the wrong way in town at some white woman. Twelve-year-old Paul Ryan never had to go to work as a trapper in a coal mine because a bunch of liberals decided that maybe it wasn't a good idea to have 12-year-olds in the workforce. That maybe it would be better if adults were in the workforce so that maybe the 12-year-old could get an education. You see, had young Alfred Aniston been merely injured instead of killed, he might wind up being the great-grandfather of one of those inner-city men who refused to work that Paul Ryan talked and talked and talked about with his little racial dog whistling. Jesus. Marty noting, so, according to capitalism, these deceased workers, like Trayvon Martin, were responsible for the incidents that caused their own death. And like Trayvon, they were sentenced to death and executed. Well, as you can see from the records of 1896, the executions took place nearly daily. Because money. That's good, Greg. So I take it Jethro Tull was thick as a brick? Yeah, very likely. Apparently didn't care much for odds and sods. Ah, come on. Little Who reference. So I think I'll knock off there for at least a brief break. I want to thank William. He just contributed this evening. I haven't said a word about fundraising. Of course, we try to raise $150 a night. Yet, without me saying a word, William said, "I enjoy your show. We have only right-wing radio here by design. I pick up your show on a little CC Wi-Fi radio. Wish I could do more. Bill from Fort Myers." Thank you, Bill. Thank you indeed. You do a lot. And thanks going out to Martin and to Jan and Jerry, who also helped out last night and early this morning. Thank you very kindly. If you care to hit the PayPal button, that is very helpful. The bills, you know, the bills are always there. The bills ye have always with ye. And frankly, I have no answer whatsoever what we're going to do about this phone system. So let's take a little St. Patty's Day break and come back. If you wish, you know, it doesn't mean we can't carry on conversation anymore. We just can't do it with the traditional phone lines. So if you don't know how to work the Skype, I guess you're kind of out of luck. But if you do know how to work the Skype and you wish to take part in the conversation, you are more than welcome to do so. We can only do it one at a time, however. At least if I'm in the middle of a conversation, I can chat back to you on Skype and let you know that, you know, I've got one call going on. So the contact there is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. This is, and we're still trying to keep it that way, Conversation Radio. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. Don't A little something from Van Morrison and the Chieftains from a 1988 album called Irish Heartbeat. That's the actual title track. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the chat room. We've got a number of chatters in the room at the moment. Good evening, Will and Waggy and the Happy Hillbilly, and good evening, Texas T and Sentient and Nydia and Mr. Gibson and Laborman and Jug of Punch and Jake Rusin and Jan and Devin and our indefatigable moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thank you. Thank you to you both, and good evening to you all. Just a reminder, if you've been trying to call the program, and I have no way of knowing if you have, but if you missed the front end of tonight's rantings, just a reminder that there's not much I can do about taking a phone call because the gizmo that got fried by Appalachian Power prevents us from taking calls. So there you have it. And I don't know how we're going to solve that problem. Sparky went and looked at the gizmo in question and sent me an inquiry via Skype chat and said, "Is this it?" "Yeah, that's it." And, yeah, it runs in excess of $3,000 to replace. That's why, among other things, we've been talking a lot about trying to pull together a Kickstarter campaign to replace a lot of aging equipment here. And we will eventually, I think, do it. It's gonna take a Herculean effort because these things are not easy. I mean, you gotta shoot a video, you gotta come up with premiums and goodies and gifts, and then you gotta figure out A, how much you need, and B, whether or not you've got a snowball's chance in hell of putting the word out far enough to raise the funds. And, of course, yeah, replacing aging equipment is a part of it. But the other part of it is, and this is very important, it's something we've been talking about for years, and I finally want to take overt, active steps to make it happen, getting the horn off the grid. Just think, if we were already off the grid, whatever it was that was so pitifully maintained that five of them blew up at 5 o'clock this morning, wouldn't have killed our phone processor. Nope. Of course, that's the if a distributed grid in which you've got a lot of people putting solar panels on their homes and it's tied into a larger grid. So if that's a smart grid, can we agree that what we have now is a dumb grid? A stupid grid, an idiot grid. Yeah, that's what this is. So you know that's why phone calls aren't coming in, and I don't want to discourage anybody from trying, but the fact of the matter is I don't know when we'll be taking calls again. And even beyond that, you know, the evening's fundraising is such that, you know, we need to raise $150 a day just to keep things cooking, just to keep the bills that we do have paid. And with that, I want to extend heartfelt thanks to Ed. Ed, who joined Bill from Fort Myers in helping reach tonight's fundraising goal. That means that between Marty and Jan and Jerry and Bill and Ed, let's see, let me do some quick ciphering. We've got $25 to go. $25 to go to meet tonight's fundraising requirements. So thank you, one and all. Where to next? I guess I kind of got lost in the whole Paul Ryan is a jerk aspect of Moran Monday and forgot that there are many other aspects of said Moranity. Let us look, for instance, to the hissies that are being occasioned by Cosmos, you know, the remake of Cosmos. Yeah. Because, you know, morons. The morons you have always with you. And, of course, this is some of this stuff is as predictable as the decay, as the rate of decay of some radioactive isotopes. If we're going to talk about science and we're going to talk about reality, then you can guarantee that there's some right-wing, repig-licking, teabagger, bircher, birther, deather, tenther, booger-eater libertarian out there that's going to have a hissy about it. This via Dr. Elizabeth Mitchell. Doctor. No, really, somebody allowed this woman to be a physician. She serves as a researcher for the Answers in Genesis Goobers. And she says,
if the first segment is any indication, Cosmos will attempt to package unconditional blind faith in evolution as scientific literacy in an effort to create interest in science. The program spent too much time describing phenomena that contradict biblical teachings.
Because we should never contradict biblical teachings, because heresy. Kathy, that works too. Kathy, writing from Kingman, Arizona, says, Bob, it's a Republican grid. Yeah, no kidding. And then also relating to Cosmos, this from, of course, Oklahoma Stan. Because Oklahoma Stan cannot have evolution. Oklahoma Stan, Fox affiliate, K-O-K-H, which oddly enough spells Coke, with a on the end. K-O-K-H TV in Oklahoma City. Oh, God, this is another moment for us to miss Bartkop, isn't it? What did he call Oklahoma? K-Drag, for knuckle drag. Bart, if you were around, and if you're wandering around somewhere out in the universe as disparate molecules now, oh, what a lovely, lovely time you would have had of this. This story goes back to March 13th. Here is the edited... And what is it with repig lickens and things missing from tapes? How much time was missing from the Nixon White House tapes that Rosemary Woods allegedly just whoopsie pushed the wrong button and made disappear? Well, in the case of KOKH TV in Oklahoma City, morons, 15 seconds disappeared. Here's the clip.
It's 9:45 on New Year's Eve.
Coming up tonight at 9, the new evidence showing our biggest earthquake could have been man.
That's not an audio problem on my end. All that silence is Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about evolution being bleeped out by KOKH-TV. Yeah. They're actively censoring stuff in Oklahoma Stan. Now, just for on the other hand, just for the fun of it, here's the edited version for teabaggers and fundies and, you know, various knuckle walking, mouth breathing, floor rolling, strychnine swilling, tongue speaking fundie. Yeah.
The universe is
hundreds and hundreds of
years old. Our entire universe emerged from a
God.
And giving birth to all the energy and all the matter we know today. I know that sounds crazy, but there's strong observational evidence to support
God.
And it includes the
Old Testament
and the
teachings of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior.
You, me, everyone. We are made of
wafers and wine.
Yeah, you get the idea. You know, it's this kind of morality that will spell the downfall of both country, culture, and who knows, maybe worldwide civilization. Bill, out in Montana just sent me a graphic. He said, I got this from Bart Cop a while back, and it shows a picture of storm clouds rolling past a church. And it says, the debate between science and religion was over when churches started putting lightning rods on their steeples. Isn't that the truth? And Marty says, I wonder if the teabaggers and booger eaters and all the other things you call them are trying to get Cosmos canceled. Oh, I'm sure they've got their purple crayon clutched madly between their toes and are furiously scrawling on construction paper even as we speak. The morons are upset about no small number of stuff. Here's a moron from Alabama Stan. You might remember last week we had, what was his name? Dr. Burton, the guy who was squealing at the Alabama Senate Science or Education Committee about how children wouldn't respect Christians and Catholics because they're two different things. Right. If Common Core standards were allowed to be taught in Alabama Stan. Well, enter State Senator Scott Beeson, a Repiglican from Gardendale, Alabama. And he's one of these freaks who isn't just worried about science, he's worried about that there literature, too. Because there's a textbook called The American Experience 1900 to Present, which is, you know, kind of a current events textbook for the current events kind of class. There's a sidebar in the book that asks students to compare the events that are depicted in Arthur Miller's play The Crucible, which is brilliant. And if you've ever seen it performed on stage, it just knocks, just pushes you back in your seat. It really does. But students are asked to compare the witch hunt events inside The Crucible, which is about the Salem witch hunt, with Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist witch hunt in the early 1950s. Like I said, enter State Senator Scott Beeson, Repiglican from Gardendale, who, by the way, is running for the Congress of the United States. Oh, goody, we'll have another one up there. And knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing Scott Beeson says that we can't be tolerating that because asking students to compare the real hunting of real witches with communists, well, that's just like that's Common Core. Yeah, Common Core. Oh, really? He's upset with Common Core because it doesn't present, quote, a conservative, honest, traditional American values worldwide. Worldview. A conservative, honest, traditional American values worldview. Because, after all, McCarthyism was patriotic. Really? Because, let's see. He said, you can't, quote, compare the McCarthy investigations of the 1950s in which he turned out to be right with the Salem witch hunts, which was, of course, hunts for real witches, because witches and demons and things that go bump in the night, and that's real. You just know he believes that. Talk about the living embodiment of that observation that for every child who ever feared a monster under their bed, there was a monster under the bed who feared the monster on top of theirs. This is that guy. By the way, Scott Beeson is also pissed off by John Muir. Yeah. There's a John Muir essay in American Experience 1900 to Present. And the essay is critical of, quote, those who are wealthy and steal timber wholesale. Scott Beeson said, that don't represent American values. We're supposed to be able to steal timber wholesale. How else are we going to retail it? Damn it. Forgive me, Jesus. Yeah. I don't know if Tim from L.A. is listening, but if you are, Tim, this is the part of the program where you get out the tennis ball and the duct tape. Scott Beeson is also pissed off. Because in this textbook there is an excerpt from an essay by John Hersey called Hiroshima, and he says he don't like that Hiroshima essay because it tells the story of the atomic bomb from the Japanese view. And that means that there's a lack of balance that undermines American values. It don't sound like we're being very good folks, does it? He's also pissed off with Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried, which is a novel about the Vietnam conflict, war, because the narrator in The Things They Carried feels regret because he killed a North Vietnamese soldier. Scott Beeson said, what is the message that's being put across? Is it that we were the bad guys in Vietnam, or was it that we were the good guys in Vietnam? I think we're the good guys. But I don't get that out of this argument. I mean, of this story. Oh, Jesus. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. With the subject line, I never really knew how bad things were in America until, Robert in Australia writes, one, White House tapes are missing 18 minutes. Two, I never really knew how bad things were in America until recently looked at YouTube. The moon landing never happened. The moon is a hologram. The earth is flat. Seriously, lizard people are walking around in human bodies. The earth is the center of the universe and doesn't move. They are easy to find, says Robert. Just search for 100% proof. A term that appears in all their titles. Three, wasn't that Cosmos dub from Family Guy? Yes, it was. Four, Sydney, Saturday afternoon, a huge thunderstorm came through. So close, the thunderclap and the lightning flash came at the same time. I started shutting everything off 3 minutes after doing so. The power went off. The local substation must have been hit, causing the circuit breakers to throw. It was out for about 70 minutes. Very sorry to hear of your troubles. Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. Yeah, just remember, average power outages in the United States are measured in days. Average power outages in a place like Germany are measured in minutes, and that is annually. I still just love that story that Brother Albert brought to the table the other night about RWE over in Germany, the coal-fired fossil fools who we just lost $7 billion this year. Don't know where it went. Oh, and hey, by the way, a little update. Here in about an hour, thanks very much to Laborman, who in the course of the Kickstarter campaign that Mike and Kathy Malloy ran so brilliantly a while back, Laborman, whom you know from the chat room, and who has also been a frequent supporter of this program, Laborman kicked into the Kickstarter over there by purchasing the You Get to Be a Guest on the Mike Malloy Program premium, and then contacted me and said, Bob, why don't you do that for me, please? You be the guest. And so here in about an hour's time, I will be joining Mike Malloy on the air for I always love my conversations with Mike. They're a lot of fun and can't be beat. So in about an hour's time, I'll be joining Mike on the air for his Monday program. Just wanted to let you know that that was on tap for this evening. So by all means, tune in. And if not that, catch the rerun somehow or another. Yeah, nice observation in the chat room by Nydia. Power outages, polluted water, dilapidated bridges, crumbling roads, but we're number one. Yeah, everybody chant, USA, 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 USA. Not having watched even a single second of those silly-ass Olympics that were recently went on, were there any groups of Americans doing the USA chant in Sochi? I will be horribly embarrassed, but not at all surprised if there were. USA, crumbling roads. USA, can't pick up the garbage. USA, can't pay more than a dollar a day for people to have food. USA, USA, greatest country in the world. Yep. First hour. Like I said, in about an hour from now, I'll be joining in answer to a question coming from Laborman in the chat room. First hour. I'll be joining Mike in about an hour from now. More morans? Oh, sure, why not? Lord, these three-hour filibusters are a bitch. I joke. There's more morans. Since we were talking about Scott Beeson in Alabamistan being right upset about that there Common Core. Well, let's not make it appear as if all the problems are in only Alabamistan. Oh, no. He's upset about Common Core. But there's other stuff that's upsetting others. Other birther, deather, tenther, bagger, bircher, booger eater, libertarian, repiglic, and Ayn Randian anarcho-capitalists. Namely, of course, as noted by that goober woman from Answers in Genesis, who doesn't want us to teach things that are contrary to the Bible. Do you ever just sit around and ponder the nightmare world of fundamentalism that this country can very easily become if the fundies ever get their way and get the totalitarian, authoritarian, Old Testament law-driven brutally fascist state for which they yearn. In other words, the theocracy. Yeah, you're toast. So am I. Oh, and I just noted, saw a note come in from our dear friend Jude. She says her maternal grandmother's family came from County Mayo. We were talking about County Mayo in the first hour of the program and the horrors of the famine there. Yeah. Also, before we go on to our next moran, the science morans, a note from our good friend Harry, writing from Baltimore. He says, as long as your phone call lines aren't working, I'll throw in my 2 cents here and there. I appreciate your unpacking the actual dollars and cents involved in the right-wing accusations of a safety hammock. But I think what is more insidious is the word hammock itself. It is, in my mind, one of the more vicious right-wing cultural memes. That was crafted, culturally speaking, to persuade people that it has something substantive behind it. A hammock is merely a way of having a place to lie down that is suspended between two trees or whatever. But in American culture, the idea or myth of leisure or relaxation because of privilege is a double-edged sword. Although the right-wing rich want the 99% to be envious of and lust for a life of leisure, they then deny that goal or dream to the 99%. To take just one example of the culture of the cultural entitlement gap, in many European countries, a 6 or 8 week of vacation every year is considered both good social policy and a cultural given. Sorry, I had to get a little heat going in here. Got real cold in here while the power was out. Here in the U.S., Harry continues, it is considered perfectly okay for employers, even nonprofit employers, to be stingy with vacation. When I lived in D.C., I once worked for a liberal professional trade association whose vacation and sick policies were blended together. And one only earned sick days and vacation days after working for this organization for a certain amount of time. I did not earn any sick days or any vacation days until I had worked for this organization for the equivalent of 6 months. The days were not earned in one lump sum, but accumulated slowly, week by week. And that's typical. Usually it takes something like 2 years of work before you even get some pissant, paltry 1 or 2 weeks worth of vacation. Thus, Harry says, when I became sick with a sinus infection within the first 3 months of my employment, and in D.C., I used to get sinus infections at least twice a year, I had no sick days to use. Thus, my boss, like me, a professionally trained person, docked my pay for all of the days I was sick. This was, I repeat, in a national professional association that had offices in both Washington, D.C. and one other city. It is a major and influential professional association known for its liberal policy resolutions. Oh, dear. Yeah, even the nonprofits can suffer from a bad case of do as we say, not as we do. Harry continues, and yet I kept losing pay for at least the first 9 months of my tenure there in a professional position that required me to work at least 60 hours a week. Because my professionally trained boss also just happened to be somewhat of a sadist, I did not stay at that nonprofit organization long enough to build up a large vacation and sick day account. But my point, Harry says, is that even among liberals in America, we don't really believe in giving all of our citizens reasonable social insurance benefits. Sick days and vacation days may sound like luxuries to the working poor, and I realize that. But what I am saying is that this kind of American dual belief, fear of the hammock, and yet envy of the right to spend time in the hammock, is part of a bigger cultural paradox that we have never fully resolved. And I agree, Harry, but I would go as far as to say also that the idea of characterizing being able to eat food as constituting some sort of unjust, unmerited leisure is an equal part of the evil that is that paradigm, that trope. So Harry says, so as much as we may be able to tar Paul Ryan as a cruel, hateful, sadistic, and hypocritical person, you forgot Parasite, Harry, our society itself gives him a kind of pass. I believe that, deep down, our American culture doesn't really want to discredit Paul Ryan completely for his beliefs, because some of us continue to tolerate these beliefs when it serves our purposes, e.g., when a large professional nonprofit organization wants to save money on sick days and vacation days. Part of our national sickness may indeed be our fear of or our inability to confront our leaders with their flaws of character or psychological health. But also we live in a culture that tolerates basic paradoxes of privilege and deprivation. That is, we both fear the hammock and we worship the hammock. So our social sickness is both psychological and cultural. We ignore either element at our peril. Thank you, Harry. I'm sorry it took me so long to get around from your note, but I get around to your note, but I do sincerely appreciate you putting that together because that really describes it quite well. And let me be clear on this topic. I believe that. And understanding how damnably dangerous that word is, I believe that when you sign on to work for somebody, I don't think you should. I don't think it's realistic. Tell me if I'm wrong. To say, well, you know, you can start tomorrow and take 2 weeks of vacation the second day. No, but I certainly hold that those 2 weeks of vacation should be yours immediately upon signing on. Or 2 weeks should be yours 3 months in or 60 days in or whatever. And that somehow trying to put you in a hole because you get sick and you haven't accrued, you know, because they've gotten down to the point where they measure it in hours and minutes. It's like the minute by minute billing of the lawyering profession has somehow inveigled itself into the American cultural psyche. The hell's wrong with 6 to 8 weeks of vacation a year? We are in essence telling the country that the only thing a human being is good for is to work for somebody else. I mean, what the hell are wages any good for if you never get to enjoy them beyond getting home, eating a little bit of dinner, collapsing into a chair, watching a little bit of Honey Boo Boo Child, and then falling asleep and getting up and doing it again? Amen. It was Mac McAnally in his song, It's My Job, who wrote, I was born to believe that there was more than to eat and excrete and die. But eat and excrete and die is the model that obtains in America. If you're listening to me somewhere outside the United States, if you happen to live in one of those enlightened states where there is mandatory paid vacation, where sick days are not a matter of parceling out minute by minute by minute accruals, then maybe you, more than an American him or herself, understand the brutality that is the day-to-day meat and potatoes of the wild-eyed anarcho-capitalism that runs amok across this country. Robert in Australia by email, I never really knew how bad things were in America until part dur. Two, I forgot to mention, Robert says, the YouTube people who are posting pictures of cities on Mars. They take a photo from the Mars Curiosity rover and zoom in on what they say are buildings and houses and on and on, and they are serious. The problem is, when you see the actual photos, these objects are only about 30 centimeters across, or less. We're talking about tiny, wee buildings. Oh, tiny, tiny Martians, Robert. Which would make the Martians about 3 millimeters tall. By the way, the objects are rocks. Rocks. Robert says, P.S., here in Oz, start a new job and you're entitled to 8 sick days a year from day one. Most employers, doctors note, if you're away for more than 2 days in a row. And it's 4 weeks vacation per year. Depending on the hours you work, that may go up to 6 weeks. And it's all paid with a holiday loading of 23%. I think it's 23. Currently, however, Tony Abbott is trying to change all that, starting with overtime, time and a half pay. Not happy. Well, that's because the American sickness is spreading. Tony Abbott didn't just come up with that. That's what the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation and all the rest of those filthy right-wing think tanks are for, is to figure out a way to drag the civilized world down to the level of the United States. Plain and simple. Thank you very much, by the way, for a kind anonymous contribution that just came in. Thank you very much. We have reached our fundraising goal for the evening. And if anybody wants to go on and start to work on Tuesday, that would be just dandy. Thank you very, very much. Because I'm, you know, with the outages, and so I'm just getting a little bit nervous here. Let's go to the Skype line. Will in Chicago is with us. Hey, Will. Will. Oh, Will. I'm hearing Skypey noises, Will. Are you there? Okay. I don't know. Something else.
Hear me now.
Now I have you, Will. Thank God it's not me. Do you hear me?
Yes. For some reason, I think it's my microphones that screwed up, so I'm talking to you via the laptop. Paul Ryan, by the way, and a few other people mentioned, reminded me of a John Kenneth Galbraith quote. The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. And I think that is one of the key problems with our society. We have people in positions of wealth and power who are only happy if they can keep everyone else down. It's rather a bit of an inferiority complex.
Well, but also consider that the people who control the money will probably just feel sick every time somebody goes on a paid vacation in this country. Because that
exactly.
means they're paying money that isn't doing them any good, because they're not sitting there slaving away.
Exactly. I mean, let's be honest. I have quipped about this before, but I think if someone were able to actually read the minds of the Koch brothers, Rupert Murdoch, and Dick Cheney, asked them, do they believe that it would be better to have slaves rather than workers? They would say yes in their innermost hearts.
Yeah, because the most you got to do is feed the slaves.
Exactly. And
you know, it's been proven that a perfectly adequate nutrition can be maintained on a diet of nothing but potatoes and milk.
Exactly. So, I mean, they, honestly, I think that those who just want to at least return us to the Gilded Age of the 1890s, which we are rapidly approaching. Our income inequality levels are comparable to 1929. And, of course, our financial system is about as stable. So I think this is why outlets like The Horn, Mike Malloy and other progressive talkers are needed, simply because we have so much of the media now dominated by six companies which essentially sell either entertainment or political distraction, or worse, political hate. See Rush Limbaugh, if you want to, for examples, ad nauseum, literally. So I think one thing we have to do is keep strong and keep at it, even if it's ridiculous that you are going to have to figure some way to come up with $3,000 to get the phones working again. And Mr. Limbaugh's biggest worry may well involve the latest supply of Oxycontin or how to get some Viagra for his next trip to the Dominican Republic.
Or the performance of his stock portfolio.
Yes, yes. And why do I think that if we have a market crash comparable to 1929 and Mr. Limbaugh is in a very tall building, people had better clear away from the ground level of that building?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so at all, Will. You know, the problem with the 1929 crash is the idea of people leaping from buildings was largely an urban myth. It might have happened a couple of times. No, you're engaged in wishful thinking there, Will, by God. I can spot wishful thinking from a mile away.
I heard it was mostly apocryphal. But, I mean, literally, it seems that we have people who, instead of wanting us to move forward into the future, want to drag us back into the idealized version of the past where the rich world, faith, instead of being something liberating as it was for Dr. King and many who march with him, is used to justify a stratified social order, and the only use of science is to produce more tools for the factories and toys for the rich.
And by the way, in confirmation of what you argued a couple of moments ago, Will, Marty just wrote in and said, given a chance to vote on it, the American people would support a return of slavery just so long as they themselves are not amongst the slaves.
I hate to say it, there are...
Slavery for thee, but not for me.
I hate to say it, I could very easily find people who would support that as long as they're not part of the group enslaved. But it's just horrific where we are right now, but I have to have faith that there can be change because change is inevitable. The problem is it's as if we're waking up in the middle of the night and we have no idea how close it is to dawn.
Oh, I think that's a very good analogy. I like to play little games with time, Will. For instance, that day in August that saw the 12-year-old young Mr. Aniston, I believe his name was. Yeah, Alfred Aniston, 12 years old, run over and killed by a load of loaded-up coal cars. 12 years old, alleged to have fallen asleep on the tracks on August the 3rd, 1896. I love to ask questions like, I wonder what Andrew Carnegie was doing on August the 3rd, 1896. I mean, you can almost, if you play with your imaginative and creative faculties, you can almost imagine him dipping the spoon into the caviar, even as in a far-flung, distant Appalachian hole in the ground, a coal car was running over the 12-year-old body of Alfred Aniston.
Yep, and I also imagine having seen The Great Gatsby that you could see someone chipping away at the ice for Mr. Carnegie to help cool things in whatever room he was in, while others were sweltering beneath the earth, lucky that they would see even a hint of a cool drink anytime within the next hour. I mean, in many ways, we are still a vastly divided nation along class lines, along racial, and along regional lines. But I do have hope in that we are at least talking to each other more, and that's one of the things that keeps the horn going. This is conversation radio. We're able to talk about issues in depth, not just 3 minutes, hard commercial break, and then move on to one of the next 20 callers. This is one of the reasons why the horn needs support. I mean, you don't have commercials to fall back on. You do not have the funding of a Rupert Murdoch or a Cumulus or a Clear Channel. It's just Bob trying to keep things running.
I just keep the plate spinning here. The keeping it running part is something that the whole horn family does with.
Exactly. And this is why
I think that's why it's such an I really revel in the idea of community.
Yes.
I see that as salvational. And that's, you know, if this was just, I don't think this would be nearly as engaging for me if it weren't, and probably I think not for the Horn family, if it weren't for the fact that we are all in this together.
Exactly. And
I mean, does anybody have a sense of community, a real sense of community, the way it's formed here in the Horn family commune? Does anybody have that sense listening to Michael Savage or Hannity or Flimball or any of those pigs?
I wouldn't know, but here's the thing. Even when we think of someone as an outsider, such as we think of Michael Savage and we don't really identify him as someone we'd like to associate, we at least will acknowledge his humanity and the humanity of his listeners. However, many of Savage's comments are too close to those that were heard on the actual Radio Rwanda, likening some human beings to cockroaches and other forms of life deemed lower.
Yeah, well, it's deemed, dangerous word, that deemed.
Yes.
How to put this? What we have going on here, I think, Will, is something that the Kochs and the Flimball, you know, they don't want. I mean, they don't sit around. They don't even know we exist. But if somebody described this, they would hate it, because it is the antithesis of everything that they want to do to America. Because you can't have community. Because remember, this is all predicated on all that Maggie Thatcher business about, you know, there is no such thing as society and there is no alternative. Tina.
Right. And I was thinking of that same exact quote as well. And this is something that I believe that the conservatives are very invested in, namely that if there's no such thing as community, we can just have the individuals focus on individual needs and try to convince people that, yes, you too will someday be among the rich and the mighty. Never mind that our social mobility rates are comparable now to Singapore.
If not less, I mean.
If not less, I haven't looked at that recently, but I know that now even Great Britain has a higher social mobility.
That's an absolute fact.
And this is rather disturbing, because we never had a formal system of nobility here. And I think people are reacting to this, but we're still groping our way in the dark, and I don't know when there'll be some significant degree of change, but history shows there will be. If we think it's hopeless, let's go back to the people working on labor and civil rights back in the early part of the 20th century. For many of them, they had to wait till the New Deal for some of their ideas to gain fruition. Some who were perhaps very young may have seen the beginning of the civil rights movement. and may have.
Yeah, because so much, you know, so much of this stuff remained in force and effect. It was so pernicious. In the case of young Andrew Aniston, on August the 4th, 1896, he was 12 years old. Well, Agnes's father was born in 1915. He too entered the mines when he was 12 years old in 1927. And he too entered the mines as a trapper. Okay? So that is, let's see, 31 years. 31 years. Yeah. And it hadn't changed.
No. No, and if we think about it, for a good chunk of that time, we had some very conservative administrations, but we still had people fighting the good fight. And
oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is the golden age of labor organizing. But remember, even when the National Labor Relations Act gets passed, and in the FDR administration will, remember that America's Republicans and industrialists raged and railed and screamed like they were being killed, that if children were kept out of the labor force, the American capitalist patriotic monopoly-based economic miracle would collapse upon itself.
Right, and then we can mention things such as General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine officer in U.S. history, testifying before Congress. He was approached by someone saying to act on behalf of bankers to overthrow the government.
And the Bush family, the Bush family was part of that consortium that approached Smedley Butler to try to foment a coup against the democratically elected government and the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, because Roosevelt was seen as being a traitor to his class.
Exactly. And the irony is FDR arguably was the person who, by implementing New Deal policies, kept us from either swinging either towards a communist or a fascist revolution. And simply because things were truly horrific. Contrary to what Paul Ryan and a few of his supporters might think, people froze to death and starved to death in major American cities during the Great Depression. And what is incredible is that we have so much rewriting of history.
Starvation was a very real thing, especially, and this goes back years in the program, but I remember an evening that Sandra and I discussed this at some length. I can't remember if it was the Smithsonian or one of the newspapers. If Sandra's listening, maybe she can help me out. But there was a report generated on what elder poverty was in the United States before Social Security, and it is harrowing, Will. It is horrifying. It's terrifying. It is tragic. It's deep grief inducing.
Yes.
And it is also the world to which the Republican Party wants to return.
Yes, because they will not be the ones suffering. Rather, they will be the tycoons and their courtiers. And they can convince enough people to go along with them thinking, okay, I'll rise up too, but generally they won't. I mean, it's more of a scheme than what Charles Ponzi did in the late 19-teens and around 1920, in which he made impossible monetary promises, paid off the first initial investors, and then everyone else lost their money.
Let's remember something, too, here. I would say probably 99% of these good-for-nothing, godforsaken, dead-from-the-neck-up teabaggers are probably the descendants of people who didn't starve to death specifically because of the Social Security that these same teabaggers now claim we cannot afford.
Exactly, and yet many of them have said, keep your government hands off my Social Security, which makes me wonder how many of them actually were asleep in class, in school, or have just decided to go on blindly unaware, believe whatever voice on a radio or a television set tells them. And this is frustrating, but I think we do have some advantages. Facts are one, passion to organize, and I think ultimately numbers. But like those who organize for unions in West Virginia and along the Pullman Railroad in Chicago and elsewhere, it's not going to be easy because there'll be those who'll fight any attempts to make life better for the vast majority of people every step of the way. Why? Because they see it as a zero-sum game. Because if other people benefit, they must suffer. Now, mind you, I don't consider not having a gold-plated faucet and toilet suffering, but...
Yeah, I'm not, I'm not that fascinated with the bathroom.
Yeah, and me either, and I don't see a need to have caviar as a staple of one's diet.
But well, here's how mean I can be, Will. We were talking about that little thought experiment with Andrew Carnegie.
Yes.
I want to apply a little bit of right-wing thinking to that thought experiment. I know,
yes.
Thinking is a term we use loosely with right-wingers and what happens in their brains.
Well, I would call it programming.
But, for instance, the anti-abortion crowd are forever hollering, and if I've heard it once, I've heard it a million times, but with all the babies what's been aborted, one of them might have cured cancer. Okay, and one of them might have grown up to roast the world in a nuclear holocaust, but, you know, never mind. Let's play with that.
Yes, let's take their.
What if you can build the time machine and go back and have Andrew Carnegie on August the 4th, 1896, choked to death on his goddamn caviar, and let Andrew Aniston live to a ripe old age?
Again, you can't tell what Andrew Aniston could have achieved in his life after a narrow escape, where perhaps someone saw him time to rescue him, and he grew up and decided that he would make a difference in his community, and perhaps his children or grandchildren would go for it. Here's the thing. If you view one life as precious at one stage of development, shouldn't it be as valuable at least once a person is born? Once a person is a baby, once a person is a child who is trying to become a man or a woman, and sadly many of those children, such as Andrew Aniston, never got the chance, and many still don't. There are places in this country where...
Hello?
Yes, hold on. I'll go in there, Jeff. I'm getting a call to make a run, but as I was, I'll finish briefly so others can call in. But if you take their argument, then shouldn't they also be advocating as forcefully so that children are fed, clothed, educated, and can make a difference in the world?
You would think. Yeah, you would.
It would be logical and consistent.
I mean, how many working people died so that the Mellons and the Rockefellers and the Fricks and the Carnegies, how many people died so that they could be fabulously wealthy? Is there an argument to be made that maybe this country would be better with those people living and these titans of industry being the ones who went the way of all flesh?
It could be made, and with that, I'd like to wish you and the Horn audience a good night. And remember, Bob still needs help with tomorrow and with the phone. So let's hang in there and let's not lose hope. It might seem dark, but for all we know, a new dawn may just be a little ways off. So let's not give up hope.
Let's not, indeed. Thank you, Will. You have a good evening.
Have a good evening.
Bye now. Our buddy Will calling from Chicago on the Skype line, and that is available to you. I mean, just because the regular phone lines are down, Skype is very, very easy to use, especially if you get yourself a nice, a decent headset with good mic quality. I mean, you've heard some great call quality via Skype on a number of programs here. And Will was even using the microphone on his laptop. That was still pretty decent quality. An email coming in from Ed, who is a dear friend and longtime supporter of the program and helped out this evening. By the way, thanks going out to Sal, who tries to make sure that he's there every night to keep things going. Thank you, Sal. Ed writes, my family line is rooted in West Virginia. Murdering the poor is normal practice for management. I witnessed a friend who was in my brother's wedding party crushed in a mold core baking machine, and a friend on third shift was killed by a flat bath of molten steel. A flat bath is an event which is a precursor to an explosion of gases in sealed containers or cavities that are lodged or trapped in the refractory of an electric arc furnace. While I was growing up, my father told me about a great-great-grandfather dying alone in a mine around Logan, West Virginia. Gordon Frenchkofer was a mine electrician charged with maintaining the shaft and tunnel power lines. Remember, this is a time when the mines had electricity, but homes did not. After the shoring and roof partially gave way, the bilge water pump stopped, and he was ordered to make the repair and told that the power was shut off. The power wasn't shut off, and he died in a pool of filthy mine water. The company blamed him for not checking for live wires. Management USA was and is so hell-bent on getting their systems and production lines running 24/7 that it has and will cost the lives of so many mothers and fathers. Ed provides a link to his great-great-grandfather, his death certificate. And it is chilling to behold. Thank you for sharing that, Ed. Thank you very much. So let's finish out the evening with one last Moran, maybe two, who knows. And like I said earlier, let us not make the false assumption that all the Morans, all the right-wing, booger-eating, birther, deather, tenther, bircher, libertarian, Ayn Randian, right-wing, repiglic, and Morans live in Alabamistan, for it ain't true. They also apparently live in Wyoming. This according to the Star Tribune of Wyoming. Wyoming is the first state to block a new set of national science standards. But a week after Governor Matt Mead signed off on the change, education advocates are still digesting what the action means for the state. Some say, there's that Fox News style book, some say the provision, which came through a last-minute budget footnote, blocks the state from considering any part of the Next Generation Science Standards, a set of K-12 standards developed by national science education groups and representatives from 26 states. Others, including the provision's author, say it prevents the wholesale adoption of the standards as they are written. Legal teams from the State Board of Education, the Wyoming Department of Education, and the Legislative Service Office are ferreting out the footnote's intent, State Board Chairman Ron Mitchell said. Right now, we're just up in the air. We don't have consensus on the board or among our attorneys on the footnote's meaning. Well, here, let me help you. It means you're not supposed to be teaching none of that demon science. Because demon science keeps children away from the saving grace of Christ Jesus. One of the lawmakers' big concerns with the Next Generation Science Standards is an expectation that students will understand humans have significantly altered the Earth's biosphere. In other words, the standards say global warming is real. That's a problem for some Wyoming lawmakers. The standards handle global warming as settled science, said Representative Matt Teeters, a Republican from Lingle, who was one of the footnotes authors. There's all kind of social implications involved in that that I don't think would be good for Wyoming. And after all, what's good for Wyoming is what is good for America, right? Because making sure that school children remain science illiterate in Wyoming is a damn fine reason for dragging the rest of the country into the murky ignorance in which Matt Teeters wallows. Here's the part of the story that'll make you cringe. Mitchell, the State Board of Education chairman, agreed. I don't accept personally that climate change is a fact. The standards are very prejudiced, in my opinion, against fossil fuel development. Whatever that word salad means. I don't think it means that he has an opinion against fossil fuel development. It means that he's a drill baby drill freak. Or maybe since it's Wyoming, maybe he wants to cut a big hole in the ground and set fire to coal underground and ruin an entire aquifer's worth of water. Maybe. You think? Poor old Pete Gosar is a member of the State Board of Education. He's also chairman of the Wyoming Democratic Party. He said, over the last few years in Wyoming, we've injected politics into education time and again, and it has been less than successful. And so here we go again. He argues that what's taught in math and science class shouldn't be swayed by public opinion. Demons! So, Representing Teeters gets the last word. We set their budget. We control what they do. You want to teach that demonic science? By God, see how you like teaching it without any damn money. Now, we got all the money in the world for you to teach that Adam and Eve rode to Sunday school on the back of a dinosaur. But I don't want to hear none of that evolution, climate change stuff. Because that stuff will send you right to hell. You know what this means. Well, I don't necessarily know that this means that, but it could potentially mean that. What this potentially means is that if there is a person of conscience who is a teacher in the state of Wyoming, after it's all hammered out and it becomes forbidden to teach the demon science in Wyoming schools, somebody's going to have to stand up and teach it. And then they're going to have to be fired. Or maybe charged with a crime. And then there's going to have to be a trial. And then we're going to find out that in the course of not quite 100 years, the United States has not gone forward. It has damned well begun to go backwards. Or, to use some of them sciencey words, retrograde motion. Because what we're going to have in Wyoming stands is the 21st century version of the Scopes freaking monkey trial all over again. And that is not going to be fun. Yeah, you do remember how the Scopes monkey trial ended, don't you? Yeah, science lost. Just saying. And thanks very much to Glenn for carrying us into tomorrow's fundraising. Thank you very much, Glenn. We will start tomorrow without quite so much of a mountain to climb. And thank you all for your contributions that keep all of this going. I'm sorry about what's happened to the telephone processor, but that's not on me. That's on Appalachian Power and their coal-fired dumb grid. Thanks to all of you who share your finite time to engage in this conversation. Thank you so very much. like I said, talking to Will, it's what makes this so very, very special. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you. You know, Ben's been saving progressive radio on the Internet for over 10 years, and he's never sent a bill. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Thank you. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.